This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast. This is the podcast for July 10th. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. And once again, we have a very special guest, Jackie. We have with us, and I think we're really fortunate to have, Steve Lott. He's the Executive Vice Chairman of Canadian Natural Resources, otherwise known as CNRL. And I think it's such an incredible story for the Canadian oil and gas industry. I mean, I'm old enough to remember in this business when CNRL was first formed in the late 80s. And Steve, I think you joined in 1991 and have driven the company with your peers to be the largest in Canada with the recent acquisitions. We'll talk about them. You acquired Shell Canada, Devon's Oil Sands Production most recently, and decidedly, as I said, the number one producer of oil and gas in Canada. Steve Lott, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thanks, Peter and Jackie. Thanks for having me on here. I'm looking forward to an interesting discussion.
Great. So what we're going to talk about today is we're going to talk about the many changes at CNRL over the past few years, as well as some general perceptions around oil sands and misconceptions that we want to get straight on. We're going to talk specifically about CNRL's GHG emission reductions, including their aspirational net zero goal, which I don't think a lot of people know about. So We want to get that news out there. And then finish with some Western Canadian oil and gas macro, including some headlines this week on curtailment and CNRL's interest in getting into the crude by rail business.
Wow. So it's a great agenda. Why don't we start with those perceptions about oil sands first? You know, the perception, Steve, and, you know, I had it again. I was giving a speech a couple of weeks ago in Toronto, and the preceding presenter was talking about renewable energy and all the cost reductions in solar and wind, and effectively made the accusation that, you know, oil and gas are high-cost producers. Canada is the highest-cost producer. And oh, by the way, oil sands is the highest cost of the highest-cost producer in the world. I mean, they're basically, you know, I had to debate them and said, okay, yeah, if you're using 2009 data, maybe that's true. But, you know, talk about these perceptions and the challenges we face.
Yeah, I know. I think it's like you say, it's a legacy perception. And a capital cost to bring on oil sands is high up front. But once you're on, say the mining at Horizon or at Albion, you have like 50, 60 years of no decline production. It's essentially a manufacturing operation. And you're able to use all kinds of continuous improvement techniques. You're able to leverage technology. You're able to do innovative because you got that massive reserve base behind you that you know is there every day. There's no declines. There's no risk. So you're really focusing on how to be effective and efficient and drive down not only your costs, but drive down your emissions, and we can talk about that here.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. But, you know, this is something that, as you said, is sort of lost. Is that, okay, we spent probably 10, 20 years up to circa 2014, 15, really making the upfront investment. I mean, the industry as a whole, I think, spent $200 billion. CNRL was a big part of that. Now we're entering the phase of optimization, learning curve effects, manufacturing. And once you get into that manufacturing mentality, you start introducing higher quality controls, progressively lower costs. I mean, how much lower can it go?
I think it can go quite a bit lower. Like we started out back in 2009, our operating costs, just on the operating cost side, were like $42 to $44 US a barrel. Today, we're about $15.
Oh.
Is that on the mining projects?
That's the mining extraction upgrading.
Upgrading. Okay. Right, so the more expensive
from
of the
mine
pathways.
Right to light sweet oil. And that's a massive drop. We still think we can do more, and we'll talk about maybe the IPEP. There's still just a massive amount of continuous improvement opportunities, just little things that add 5, 10 cents a barrel, and you just do hundreds of these things every year, and the more you do, the more you find. But it's really being more effective, more efficient, getting better reliability, better utilization. So those things all drive costs down, and they drive greenhouse gases down, and your capital costs go down because you learn how to maintain the plant much more effectively.
Right, you just create that base, that foundation of expansion. You know, it's interesting that I remember back, again, around 2000, where I think it was one of your competitors in the oil sands, their mantra was $10 by 2010 or something like that, right? That was the goal before we had, you know, the massive inflationary period and sort of wiped that whole thesis out. But it seems to me now you're at 15 bucks, you're headed for 10.
You know, you're going to try and do that. And it's going to be tough sledding because you get the easy stuff first, but I think it's possible. And if you look at the oil sands for the mining operations, and even in a certain extent, the SAGD, there's a big curve there that come down as well. At Horizon, Albion, $25 oil, we're still making cash flow and we're still doing okay. Yeah. You can't say that for many other projects because they decline. And you have to have the cash flow to reinvest to keep your production up. And that's the beauty of oil sands. And that's why it makes it very competitive in the world.
And it's really what investors want now. Investors are saying, hey, don't keep, you know, the cash that comes out, don't put that all back in the ground. We want to see some of that in the forms of dividends and buybacks. And we have a macro model of the Canadian industry. And for the last several years, the oil sands industry as a whole has been generating about $30 billion of cash flow and only putting about $12 billion back. And they've been growing still. So that's very unique. If you look at the conventional side of your business, you don't have that ability to take out that much cash flow because you do have declines that you need to offset. And so I think it actually is well suited to what investors are looking for today.
Yeah, I think it's one of the advantages you have with the oil sands. I will say on our conventional business, we free cash flow there too, but not to the same degree. And there's a lot more risk on that free cash flow because you got to reinvest to keep the production flat. But on Horizon or Albion, you have no risk. It's all about manufacturing and getting your
costs. Manufacturing, just for our listeners, sort of just put everything into context. So Canada's largest oil and gas producer, you're what, 700,000 barrels equivalent? No, you're over a million.
1.1 million
right,
million
with the Devon acquisition. So yeah. 1.1 million barrels. What fraction of that is oil sands and what fraction is not?
We're about, I would say, 450,000 of mining oil sands. Now about 200,000 of like thermal, SAGD, cyclic. And then the rest is conventional, light oil, North Sea, Africa, and Wembley, those kind of things. So we have that plus some heavy oil, primary heavy oil production. And then we got about, I'd say about 200,000 BOEs equivalent of natural gas as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So some, I mean, just mental math, it's about two-thirds, one-third in terms of oil sands versus conventional.
And you have a very unique perspective on Canada, not only because you're large, but you are actually operating in all the, we have a lot of diversity in our basin. I'm in a lot of different types of production and you're exposed to many of those. Maybe we should talk a little bit about greenhouse gas emissions because another perception is that oil sands are some of the highest GHG intensity crudes in the world, but that's changing too. I'm going to highlight a recent presentation that shows your oil sands well to combustion emissions relative to other crudes around the world. And you're showing that your operations are actually close to the average of crude oil that's consumed in the United States right now, not actually the high emissions that oil sands is perceived to have.
And I think that's true, Jackie. And I think the world has changed dramatically in the last 10 years. And I think, to me, this is a real, true Canadian success story, and people don't really know about it. But if you look at the Canadian oil and gas industry, we recognized that we need to do something about our greenhouse gas intensity. And we worked together, and Canadian Natural's done a great job here, but we reduced our emissions, you know, significantly. We got carbon capture. But now you're close to the average, and in some cases, we're below the average. And we're not done yet. And I think, you know, we talked about that net aspirational goal. Our goal is to get to zero.
Net zero.
And I think it's doable. And I think that's what Canadians should be proud of, especially for working in the oil and gas business, to be able to leverage technology, to be innovative and use that Canadian ingenuity to reduce that emissions intensity is truly remarkable. And we're now, so if you look at the world today, if you really believed you got to do something about greenhouse gases, you had to take action, which I think most people do, then you should say Canadian oil, Canadian gas should be on the global market because greenhouse gas emissions will go down if you have Canadian oil from oil sands or any source or Canadian gas replacing production from any other source in the world. So that's why you need market access. And we got to flip that story because it's really important for Canadians to, if they really want to take action, because you're not going to get rid of oil and gas right away. You should have Canadian oil and gas on there.
And the perception has been in the past, you know, oil sands are so high emission, that's the source of supply that shouldn't be there. We should use the lower carbon sources. But what you're saying is very quickly here, we're becoming average or better than average. We're going to continue to accelerate our innovation so that by using a barrel of oil from Canada, you're actually producing less emissions than using other alternative sources of supply. And so from a global perspective, we're better off.
We are better off. And then you'll... One of the interesting study done just on flaring regulations and venting in Canada, if the whole world had the same high standards as we have here in Canada, it'd take off basically 110 million cars off the road, which is three times what it would have in Canada. Mm-hmm. Just by switching out by burning Canadian oil and Canadian gas and just on the flaring part of it, not just the emission reduction. So it's massive change on greenhouse gas impact if you use Canadian products.
Yeah. For our audience and our listeners, I want to talk about the range of upstream emissions, not the entire well to wheels, because you know 80% of the emissions are burnt in the vehicle. where the real differentiation happens is in that upstream part. So it can range anywhere from, I think it's 20 or 30 kilograms per barrel of oil to—
Kilograms of CO2 per barrel of oil produced on the upstream side.
Upstream side, all the way to over 100. The U.S. average is about 60. And I know that, you know, if you use the 2009 data, as I said, you know, some of the people who continue to use old data, they categorize oil sands as being 100 plus. But you've brought it down below that U.S. average of 60 on certainly new projects. And that's a really a remarkable achievement on a percentage basis. It's almost been cut in half.
Yeah, and it's just not— I'm speaking for Canadian Natural, but it's the whole industry, all other players. So this is a remarkable story that, you know, we've done great things, but everybody's done similar great things. And so as a Canadian, as an Albertan, and if you work in the oil and gas business, you should be really proud of this. Like, like this is leveraging, this is a high-tech business, and people don't think that, but there's a huge amount of technology being done here.
Well, let's take it further. Yeah. Net zero.
Let's describe what net zero is for our audience. Maybe now it's somewhere closer to the average near 60 kilograms of CO2. But when you say you want to drive all the way to net zero, does that mean you want to have zero emissions on your upstream oil and gas production?
That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to take it from 100 to 60 to zero. And I think we can do it. And we're not that far away. We haven't put a deadline on ourselves, but we're not that far away. Technology can make it happen.
And would you see that happening through using offsets? So, for instance, Shell has talked about, you know, planting trees to offset some of the CO2 emissions.
You can do that, but we're trying to do it just ourselves. Like, just try to use
technology. Not with offsets.
Not with offsets. Just trying to make it happen. And, you know, we've got carbon capture and storage. You know, the other thing that's coming, I think it's close, in some cases it's there, is carbon capture and conversion. So when you think about it, when you see CO2, it's carbon and oxygen. These are not scary molecules, Peter. We breathe it every day. So it's not like you got some kind of radioactive material here. You can use that and make other products. And I'll give you a story. There's a little company out there called Clean O2, maybe a little advertising for them, but they are in hotels in Vancouver, Calgary, and Edmonton, and they capture the CO2 from the flue gas in the boilers in the hotel. They convert that CO2 into soap. And that soap is used by the hotel to do the laundry. So it's just one little, like there's many products that can be made, like carbon nanotubes, methanol, all kinds of products can come off CO2 if you do it right. So it's a chemistry problem that can be solved.
Yeah, it's interesting if we reframe our vernacular around this problem. And emissions are considered to be negative, waste, pollutant, et cetera, et cetera. But if you actually think of CO2 as a side stream of something that has value that can be converted into other higher value products.
It can be a revenue stream.
It can be a revenue stream.
Right.
And I think this is the way the industry is starting to think. And it's something that should be encouraged. As I said, it's not only a different way of thinking about the business, but also an attitudinal change about waste versus useful.
Well, and I wanted to talk a little bit about carbon capture and storage, because I don't know that all Canadians, our listeners, know that you're actually actively operating a carbon capture and storage. And what do you think of that technology?
So we have carbon capture at Horizon. We have it at Scotford through Quest. And we're going to have it at Northwest when we get fully running. Each one of those captures the CO2 is essentially the same. We take it off the hydrogen plant because it's a pure stream of CO2. It's easy to capture. At Horizon, we use it in our tailings. So we mix the CO2 with our silts and clays. And the water's still hot or warm when it's coming out there. You mix it. The CO2 chemically reacts. I'll try not to be too chemistry here, but it reacts with the clays, and it squeezes out the water. So the clay particles actually sort of squeeze together. The water comes out warm. Then we take out the tailings pumped out are basically sort of like a paste. So what happens, a bunch of things happen. One is you get your water back warm, so you don't have to heat up as much, less greenhouse gases. You put a paste out there, there's not water out there, so tailings ponds get smaller. You get the water back sooner, so you're recycling less water, so you're less fresh water usage, and our operating costs go down. So all kinds of good things happen with that CO2. At Quest, they take the CO2, same thing off the hydrogen plant, and they inject it in deep water, salt water aquifers way down, and just... it's there for good. And at Northwest, the refinery there that's getting going here, it's a trunk line. It's going to go in ER, big old pools, big old oil pools are sitting there. It fills up with CO2, but you also cycle it. It'll change the viscosity of the oil, and you get more oil out. So it's a win-win-win everywhere mm-hmm. around.
And that project with the Redwater Refinery and the Alberta Trunkline is not well known in Alberta. So we're actually going to talk more about it on the podcast mm-hmm. in the fall, because it's 15 million tons of potential ability to move CO2. They still have to, you know, get more sources and more places to put the CO2, but it has real potential to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions here in Alberta.
It can make a big difference.
Yeah. So can I ask you another question about the tailings? I mean, it's been mentioned that the tailings may be materially rich in the metals like vanadium mm-hmm. and others for batteries. Is that true?
It is true. We're working on a pilot, and we're working with Titanium Corporation mm-hmm. together, and we got a pilot going here where you try to extract, you know, vanadium and titanium, and you're trying to get all those minerals that are used for batteries for solar panels.
Right.
And we actually reduce our greenhouse gases because of that, because you're awesome. One of the things we get is a little bit of oil that's in the tailings. You get all that out too. So there's all kinds of positive benefits that can come from these things. Mm-hmm. And these are all technologies, Peter, that people never thought about before, because you're just so focused. In the last 20 years, it was all about how do you get the thing built on cost,
yeah.
on time, and get it up and running. And now that we're there, like you say, you have 50-year reserve life, you can think about putting a plant on there to capture titanium.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how does your, let's just talk a little bit about the organization at CNRL. I mean, you're thinking very strategically with your management team and everything else. So is this culturally now dispersing into the organization to think differently?
You know, it's interesting. Canadian Natural has a unique culture, and it's not a top-down, like there's top-down stuff, but reality, we're very frontline driven. So we have these goals to get to net zero, and everybody has great ideas at Canadian Natural. So there's no filter. It doesn't have to come from the VP of technology or VP of production. It can come from anywhere. And if you look at the cost reductions we've had at Horizon and then CO2 or GHG emissions reductions, a lot of that comes from the operators in the field going like, why are we doing it this way? And then you go, yeah, I don't know why we're doing that. And then it creates the idea, and lots of things can happen out of that. So it's bottoms up everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. And you need that, I guess, to surface every good idea, right?
There's thousands of great ideas out there.
Yeah. I wanted, just before we leave GHG, a lot of discussion goes on in Canada about our Paris target and, you know, how can we increase our oil and gas production, and especially we talk about LNG exports, and still meet our Paris target of a reduction of 30% by 2030. How do you look at that problem?
To me, I look at it as an opportunity, not a problem. And so people, they want to constrain it to just Canada. And greenhouse gas emissions, climate change is not a Canadian problem. It's a global problem. So you should think globally. If you think globally, then you should be building as many LNG plants as you can get built, because that'll replace coal. It's just as cheap as coal. And that's the thing people got to realize. I'm going down a sidetrack here, but people need energy, and they need affordable energy. If you're out in poverty and you're trying to get out, you don't really care so much about greenhouse gas emissions. You care about feeding mm-hmm. your family. So if you can get cheap gas there, that's what we should be doing.
And cheaper than coal, actually.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. So you should be thinking, Canadians should be thinking globally. How do we get down to the 1.5 or 2 degrees? Let's get more gas on the water. Let's get more Canadian oil on the water to people that need it. And that'll reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
I think the LNG has been at the forefront of starting to create that narrative and understanding about Canada's role in the world. I mean, there's just to this point in our podcast here, you've discussed about all these great things. Can you talk a little bit about getting the word out a little bit more and how CNRL is thinking about, you know, as Jackie said earlier, I mean, I don't think it's well known at all that you are and your organization are driving towards a zero emission kind of target.
We're starting to talk about it more. And, you know, that's part of the culture of the company, Peter, Jackie. You know, I don't like to be in the news that much, so we try to fly it on the radar. We know that we can't do that as much now, so we're talking. That's probably why I'm here today, because mm-hmm. it's a good message. It's a good message, and you guys mm-hmm. have some scope that people listen to, and it's important that they hear all the great things that the oil and gas industry is doing.
Right, and that our production is actually lower carbon than others, so why would we shut in our production, right? We should grow it.
Should grow
displace
it.
Other suppliers that are higher carbon.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's just like you have the team, and you're wanting to cut the best players off the team. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it's tough.
Think about the team being the global set of oil and gas producers, and you want to cut the ones that are innovating the most and the fastest and have these targets that most of the other ones don't have. Like, why on earth would you want to divest and cut those? It's a whole separate topic. But I mean, we've got to get the word out of what you're doing. It's really fantastic.
And I'll have to say, you got to give credit to the other side, the detractors, the opponents. They have been very, very effective. And they use that 2009 data. Even now, when you come out, we talk about these things. I remember when we first started talking about it, they interviewed somebody from one of the detractors, say, oh yeah, but that doesn't matter because that's just the new stuff. It's old stuff. It's really bad. Well, I'm talking the whole global thing here, but they're very selective on how they do it. And you know, to me, it's really difficult. It's almost like trying to get a Leafs fan to decide they should be a Boston Bruins fan, or try to get a Oilers fan to say they should be a Flames fan. Maybe, but you don't really want to do it, right?
No
matter what the facts are, it's tough to do.
Yeah.
So if you're really entrenched that oil and gas is bad, it's a difficult leap to say Canadian oil and gas is actually better than the rest, and we're still going to need oil and gas, so let's get our product on there mm-hmm. and not use some of this more polluting type stuff that comes from the rest of the world.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. And I think we do have to break this 2009 data myth. I mean, that's just 10 years ago. I mean, your company and the companies in the oil sands and oil and gas in general space have come so far, even in the last 3-4 years. Do you want to talk about the macro?
Yeah, let's talk about the macro. So I know you don't like to make news, but you were making news headlines this week when CNRL talked about the fact they're interested in taking on rail capacity, and also that a group of producers has been talking with the Alberta government about the potential for keeping the curtailment in place, if I think I understand it, but allowing people to produce over that level if they were to move the crude out of the province by rail, which I think is a great solution. And we've talked about that before. I think that's a great solution to incenting rail movements while still keeping the market managed and not having big blowouts in our differentials.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, we talked about it, and I think it was basically at a panel yesterday at the Stampede. There was ourselves, Synovus, Husky, Imperial, and Suncor. And we all kind of said the same thing. One of the things we said is, just like you said, if you want to get more rail and you want to lift curtailment, then they should go together and maybe even lag a little bit to make sure you don't distort the market. The one thing that didn't get really picked up yesterday in the media, probably because it's kind of complex, is what you really need to have to go with that is the nomination rules adjusted to be more modernized for what the market is today. And I think you got to have both of those. Mm-hmm. And maybe you could do it in stages, but...
Can we talk about that a little bit? I mean, I think that's not really well understood at all by our audience and many people, like the nomination process for pipelines and things
like
that.
Yeah, maybe I'll give some context. So the Enbridge Mainline, which moves about 70% of all the oil out of Western Canada, and is a very important conduit, is all open for all shippers to be able to ship on it. And there's a process where you say each month how much crude you want to move. Everyone does that. And then if it's oversubscribed, which it has been for some time because we're short pipeline capacity, then there's a process to give everyone their fair share. But you were very vocal when you came on BNN and said you had some concerns that the space was not being given away equally to all parties, and that was causing prices to be depressed. So maybe give us a bit of background on that.
Yeah, I just want to clarify again for our audience this nomination process. So putting some numbers to it, say, you know, company producer, oil and gas producer X says, I nominate 50,000 barrels to go on a pipe that can carry what? What does a pipe carry, did you say?
So, 2.7 million barrels.
2.7 million. Yeah. Okay, so everybody nominates, and if there's over nomination in excess of the total capacity of the pipe,
which lately has been like 40% more.
So the producers have to get cut back. So the company X that nominated 50,000 barrels a day gets cut back to, say, 40. The problem was, I think,
more
Steve,
like half.
Or more like half. Okay. So, I mean, the problem is that recognizing that, company X then says, okay, I'm going to nominate 100,000 barrels, more than I even have, to cut back to 50, because I know I'm going to get cut back to 50. Isn't that part of the issue?
There is some rules. It's trickier for producers to do that. So the rules are you can't really nominate more than you have capacity for or what storage you have. So you can nominate that. So what happened here? And this marketing nomination process, it's very opaque. And the marketers, the true marketers, want to keep it that way because it's really difficult to explain. So a producer, like you said, has 50,000 barrels a day. He's got 50,000 barrels a day of production. He has to produce every day, every month. He nominates it. He gets cut back 40%. So he's only going to be able to produce 30,000, can only move 30,000, but he's producing 50. So he has to find somebody to sell it to. So after the apportionment, there's what they call a post-apportionment market. So So it's a spot market. And then there's people there that go, okay, I actually nominated a bunch of barrels, but I don't actually have them. So I'll buy them from you since you have them. And by the way, it's so tight now. So if the differential was $25, say for heavy oil off WTI, in the post-apportion market, we've seen people say, I'll buy it from you from 35 and then 40 and then 45 because it just blew the whole market out. And the way this worked, because the rules were never contemplated for when the market access was very tight or more supply than takeaway, is if you're a player, mostly they're U.S. type guys that have refineries and have storage and have different transportations, you could nominate a bunch of different places. So you could nominate your 50,000 barrels a day to go down Enbridge. You could keep it in storage. You could nominate to a refinery here in Alberta, or you can nominate to a different pipeline. So that 50,000 barrels a day from certain players that had the ability to do it, mostly U.S. guys, they could go to a bunch of places. And then they got ratcheted back and they got 30,000 here, 30,000. Yeah. So they got all kinds of room. So now they get the poor producer that's stuck there, no place to go, and it took all the market power to these U.S. players that play the game.
And you say it's opaque, and it is. But the good news is part of the concerns that were raised, and you were one of the people that raised the concerns, there was a report issued by the NEB in March that actually explains this. Even though there's no real data, the NEB has come out and said they believe that some shippers have a disproportionate advantage for accessing space, getting more space than they intend to ship, and that the verification process, they believe, needs to be improved. They had some ideas of that, and they recommended that it be studied. And then later, the Minister Sohi, from our Natural Resources Minister federally, wrote a letter saying he would like to put together a task team to figure out how we can do this better. There are ideas out there. And so I don't know if you've heard any update in terms of where that is at, in terms of studying how to improve this problem.
Yeah, so I'm going to step back a little bit, because Enbridge kind of gets slagged on this quite a bit. It's not really an Enbridge mainline problem. If there's some issues there to get fixed, I think are fixable. It's really upstream of Enbridge. That's all the issues. So the terminals, the storage facilities, all the feeder pipes, they don't really keep track of it, and they have no incentive to, and allows people to double nominate. So we know the Alberta government can do something about this, and they want to. They understand it. We've been told their first priority is to get something done on rail. Then we're going to do the nomination process. And you can imagine there is huge pressure from people that profit from the loopholes in this system to not to change it.
Well, I mean, you know, what you're describing earlier with all these numbers, I mean, I'm sure it makes many of our audience members' heads spin. Certainly makes mine spin. It's complicated.
Yeah, and there's, you know, we've made recommendations. There's a producer group that's actually made recommendations as how they can fix this. And it has to be enforceable, because with rules that aren't enforceable, doesn't really mean anything. So we've made recommendations, and I think the government understands it, but you know, that's our view. There's other views that want to keep that open.
Now, I want to talk about, Enbridge has proposed that they are going to change the way that the pipeline space is allocated. Today, it's a common carrier where everyone has, each month has to try to get space on it. They want to change it to a firm service where 90% of the capacity would be tied up with committed shippers, and then there'd be 10% that would be available for spot shippers. Do you believe if they make this change, it's still important that we fix this process, because there still will be spot capacity that needs to be allocated?
Yeah, absolutely. It needs to be fixed. It's probably even more important then, because there's less capacity. So, you know, we've got to be really careful here on this firm capacity, whether we should even be doing it. And I know Enbridge wants to do it, and I know the refiners in the Midwest really want it, and the marketers really want it. And we've got to be careful we don't shift all the market power to the buyers and not the producers. And I know Enbridge is trying to work ways to try not to have that happen, but market power could easily switch to that.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, just again, to try and simplify what is an extremely complicated subject, we have producers who then transit their oil via pipe to refineries who are the consumers, the customers. And we don't want to create a situation where the refiners or the pipes or even the producers have disproportionate amount of the market power that upsets the economics. We want balance, right? Which means we want to preserve certainly some of the common carrier dimension of this, so producers can get on had producers, some of which in this province are smaller, much smaller than you, and I think that's really important to have, in the internet world, it's called net neutrality, where you have equal access to the internet if you're, whether you're Amazon or Netflix or whomever, small, big, doesn't matter. I mean, I think we need to have some sense of pipe neutrality here.
That's what a common carrier system really
does.
That's
what a common carrier system is.
And it allows little companies to grow.
Yeah.
And I know Amer's just trying to make systems, but you still got to put your balance sheet up to get capacity.
Right.
Which, by the way, is not incremental.
In other words, hard cash you have to put up.
Exactly. So it's tough on the little guys, and you have to ask yourself, as an Albertan, as the Alberta government, do you want to hamper or sort of handcuff the little producer that can actually create a lot of employment, drive a lot of economic activity? Something got to think about.
And we definitely have concerns. Just to put it in perspective, if you look at all the takeaway capacity out of Western Canada, today 85% is for spot shipments, you know, not owned by anyone. And this change would flip that to 15%.
Can you just, like, spot shipment?
So basically, nobody has the right, because when it's firm, it's like a company has signed up for many years to exclusively have the right to use that space.
Like a contract.
Today, 85% of the capacity out of Western Canada is available month to month. And of course, there's a non-perfect system for allocating that space. But in a time when we're so short pipeline capacity out of Western Canada, we know it has effects even on spot price, it seems like a very major change to be making.
Yeah, and if you look back in August of last year, Enbridge tried to change the way the nomination process did. They did a quick thing.
Of 2018.
Yeah, they did it for one day, then the next week they changed it back because inadvertently they switched all the market power right to the refiners, and the differential popped like five to $10.
Yeah, it got worse.
Right then. Yeah. And they flipped it back to the way it was before, dropped $5-$10. So they kind of have a dry run for what could happen. Now, there's ways probably to minimize that, but it's something we should all be concerned about.
And so this is all occurring because we're in this new era of pipe constraint. But what about rail?
Yeah, let's talk about crude by rail. How much crude by rail does CNRL move today? And what's your interest in getting into crude by rail?
You know, we move about 14,000 barrels a day. Not a lot compared to our size. And I think we're interested in looking at it. You know, rail, to be honest with you, you'd rather move by pipe. If you can move by pipe, that's the best way to go. It's the safest, most environmentally friendly. But in today's world, you got to look at rail, and we'll take a look at it and see if it makes sense. But I think you got to be careful here that we just don't go do rail and not address the nomination issues. Those have to be addressed.
Fixing this Enbridge nomination is important, even as we get alternatives, because when Enbridge expands the pipeline with the Line 3, this is 3 million barrels a day of takeaway capacity. And so the Enbridge mainline will always be the most important pipeline and way of moving crude out of Western Canada, such a substantial part of our takeaway capacity and two key markets. Let's move off quickly. We're kind of running out of time here, but I wanted to quickly talk to you about the natural gas market in Alberta. Prices have been very weak, averaging about $1.50 Canadian per gigajoule, about 70% discount compared to the U.S. pricing over the last few years. And lately, prices even worse. In fact, we had 50-cent gas average in June, just last month. Any thoughts on that? I know the Alberta government has been working with industry to think about how we could improve this market.
Well, I got to give credit to the Alberta government for jumping on it. They're trying to make something happen. It's a very difficult problem, as you guys know. There's just way too much gas in North America. There's way too much gas in Western Canada. And that's why prices are low. We got a bunch of gas trapped here in Alberta. And so that'll drive more supply, less demand. Prices go down. It's pretty simple. So we need to get more access to market. And you can get, there's some coming. There's coming, but that'll get us access to Chicago and a few other places. I don't think prices are going to get that much stronger because of it, because there's just so much supply.
Well, we're just too good at getting it out of the ground. Basically, the technology over the last few years has allowed us to create almost an unlimited amount of capacity in a short period of time.
And a lot of the gas comes now from liquids rich or associated gas from oil. So the gas, in a way, has become almost like a byproduct.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a tough game to play.
Yeah, and that's what's enabled the market to stay oversupplied despite these very low prices. So I think we're coming to the end of our time.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just want to, it's just a fascinating discussion. And it sort of hopefully gives our audience some insights into the complexity of the business. But as I said at the outset, I mean, CNRL is a remarkable story in terms of what it has grown to, 1.1, 1.2 million barrels per day. In fact, that means that you are the eighth largest producer of oil and gas in the world now, which is—
Yeah, when you take out national oil companies.
When you take out the national oil companies, but still, I mean, you know, you've got ExxonMobil, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, et cetera. And the eighth down the list would be CNRL.
Yeah, that came from Wood Mackenzie. We didn't actually quality check that one, but it said that after the majors and ConocoPhillips, there is CNRL. That's pretty incredible.
We don't look at it that way. We don't try to be the biggest or anything. We're really focused on being effective, efficient, minimizing our environmental footprint, having our teams work together to be innovative and create value. And that's what we focus on. And the outcome is that you grow, but that's what you got to focus on.
Well, I know you don't focus on it, but in an era where we're saying, I think, as you even said, the world needs more Canada.
Yeah.
I think it's an awesome story. So the question says, when are you going to be number 7 or 6? What's next?
Who are you buying next, Steve?
We have no gaps in our portfolio, Jackie, so we don't need to buy anybody. And that's always our answer. We're not actually out there looking to buy anybody. And so everything we do buy is kind of like a public market, so it's not a...
I mean, you've been extremely effective in buying and integrating, optimizing, bringing your costs down. And I imagine, post your Devon acquisition, you're going to be doing that. But at some point, probably, you're going to be looking around and seeing that, boy, there's more to be done. And we look forward to that.
Good. Thanks for joining our podcast.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And thank you, listeners, for joining. If you like this podcast, please tell someone else about it, rate us on an app, and please subscribe.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.